City Talk 105.9. Official podcasts. Online at citytalk.fm.
The best of Brian Reid. Brian Reid. On City Talk 105.9.
Hello, this is Brian Reid. And between now and 8 o'clock, there's another chance to hear the best of my Saturday morning show here on City Talk 105.9, the voice of Liverpool. I've got Lynn Papadopoulos with me. And I've just been joined, I'm pleased to say, by Isabel Phillips. Hi, Isabel.
Hiya.
Now, the Israeli government has, for the past fortnight, banned all foreign media from entering the Gaza Strip, which is occupied by Palestinians, those where Palestinians live. There's been killings, there's been shellings, there's been repression. Isabel Phillips is a Liverpool woman who's a volunteer for the International Women's Peace Service. She spent this summer in Palestine witnessing terrible human rights abuses, and she's here today to share those experiences with us. I got that right, apart from the bit that I said it's been the Palestinians occupying the Gaza Strip.
Yeah, unfortunately.
It's the other way around.
Yeah.
No, but this is really serious because, I mean, I've read some of the things that you saw over there, and it's quite horrific what's going on. And what's so horrific about it is it's not getting out, is it?
No, I think that's what's, from my experience, that was the worst and most frustrating thing is that, I mean, I've read a lot about what goes on in Palestine from my own interest in it, and you try and find sources that, you know, aren't as common to people over here, and you dig out and you dig out, but it's not until you get there that you really realise how bad it is. I mean, some of the things that go on there, it's absolutely horrific. People look back now at apartheid in South Africa and say how awful that was, and what goes on there, I was absolutely appalled. I cannot believe in this day and age that goes on, and what we hear over here is just not the same.
How long were you over there for?
I was there for almost 3 months.
Had you been there before?
I was there a year earlier, just for a month, doing a programme with a local university. But this time I was living in a Palestinian village in the West Bank and felt that I really got to see exactly what daily life is like for a Palestinian.
And your official role is kind of monitoring, isn't it? And helping, if you can, in a peaceful way. But it's monitoring any kind of human rights abuses, any kind of deviance from what the Israeli government is supposed to be doing. Is that?
Yeah. I mean, where we could, we would try and intervene, but, I mean, the Israeli army, no one's going to tackle them. People can't tackle the Israeli government. I mean, we did as much as we could trying to reason with soldiers or people that came up against the Palestinians, but the only thing that I felt was a useful thing that I could do is to come home and tell people what's going on. Because for the Palestinian people, I think they just feel completely and utterly abandoned, because everything that's reported over here, you know, people feel they have to give some kind of balanced view, but the situation's not balanced. It's not, you know, people call it a conflict. It's not a conflict. A conflict gives the impression that there's two sides battling. They have some kind of, you know, they're both going to get somewhere in this conflict. It's not a conflict. It's, you know, a handful of awful incidents that happen against Israelis, you know, not taking away the suffering of the incidents against Israelis, you know, these rockets that are fired over, but it's like a comprehensive oppression of 2, 3, 4 million people, you know, and it's daily, every single day, collective punishment against the whole population.
Give us an example of let's say, the worst thing that you saw there.
God, it's hard to even come up with the worst thing.
Did you see people shot?
Yeah, I mean, I attended the funeral of a 10-year-old boy, and this boy is 10. He lives in a tiny village that depends completely on agriculture. It's surrounded by the Israeli separation wall. I mean, I don't know how much background I have to give on this, but the Israelis are building a wall, and that goes around the whole of the West Bank, which they say protects the Israeli public from Palestinians. Now, this wall, it doesn't just go around the West Bank, it goes around every single settlement that is an area that the Israelis have moved their own population to in the occupied Palestinian territories, which is illegal under international law. And they are building this wall so that it includes every settlement. So it goes within the border of the West Bank, and that means it isolates these tiny Palestinian villages that fall between settlements and Israel proper. Now, this boy lived in a village where the majority of the land had been already taken by a settlement that the Israelis had confiscated the land for their own civilian population. And this wall went up. It stopped them going to school. It stopped them people going out to work. And it took away even more land that they depended on. So the only thing the Palestinians are left with is to be able to stand up, go to that wall every day and say, we want to stop this. We stand up against this. All their demonstrations are non-violent. There is real authority in these villages. People look up to the elders. And the one thing these elders do is say to all the youth, because, I mean, it's the youth that are going to, they're the people who can't go out and get jobs. That's where the frustration really boils up. And they're so clear, say, no violence, no anything. This is us showing our respect for humanity. We just want to stand here and say this is wrong. And this boy went and did this, and the Israeli border policeman came within 10 metres of him and fired live ammunition, and he was killed instantly, shot in the head. Now, one of the important things is that we did, we went along to these demonstrations because it's an actual policy within the Israeli army that they will only use live ammunition when there's no internationals present. Mm. And on this occasion, when 10-year-old Ahmed was shot, there was no internationals there. And we went along to his funeral. And it was horrible. I mean, any funeral of a child is just disgusting. But when we got to the village, I mean, I don't know if people have seen funerals over in the Middle East. You know, they're more of an open, it's not kind of, you know, a quiet procession along, and especially when there's somebody killed by the Israeli army. And when we turned up at the village, you know, there's thousands, everybody out in the village had turned up for the funeral procession. And instead of just letting the village be, you know, they'd just killed a 10-year-old boy, the army stood on the surrounding hills, surrounding the village, and attacked the funeral procession with stun grenades, sound bombs, rubber bullets. And I think just that just hit me, the absolute inhumanity with which they treat people.
And reading the stuff that you've written, which is quite moving on your blog, you talk about the fact that the soldiers are supposed to be there to help the situation, to be fair, to be impartial. But they clearly are just standing by, allowing things to happen and on occasions goading it.
Absolutely. I mean, some of our work involved going out to help people harvest their fields. I mean, as I said earlier, a lot of their livelihoods depend on agriculture. And there's a lot of problems because of the settlers who live in these illegal settlements. Jewish settlers. They come out and they will intimidate and often attack Palestinians who are trying to work in the field. So in 2005, I think it was, the Israeli High Court ruled that soldiers must protect Palestinians. They must be able to access the land and they should facilitate this access. Now, just one incident I was with, we went with a small family who just had a few almond trees in a couple of fields, and it was near an Israeli settlement. So they'd asked us to go along with them because they feared they'd been attacked in the past and they feared attack. So we went along with them. I think we got to, walked about 100 metres. We were spotted by a settler. He then made phone calls. You could see him making phone calls. And within minutes, three settlers have turned up, all with huge machine guns. Well, not machine guns, I don't know, M16s. I don't know how to describe them technically. And all the family consisted, I was with, was a 20-year-old girl, a 16-year-old boy and a 10-year-old. Now, all they wanted to do was literally go to their fields, get to the trees, and all they had to do was pick a few almonds off the trees, and that would, you know, provide for the family for a bit longer. So immediately we tried to call the army to say, look, we need protection here. These soldiers turned up, only spoke in Hebrew, even though the ones working in the West Bank always have to have a minimum of Arabic so they can communicate with the Palestinians. They only spoke in Hebrew, only spoke to the settlers, didn't listen to anything we had to say, came over and told us we had to leave the land. There was nothing, you know, they weren't going to protect us. They weren't going to do anything. And they sat there while the settlers then started to just push the boy and the family, particularly the 16-year-old, trying to antagonise him. They tried to take away the family's donkey. They tried to... And the soldiers did absolutely nothing. Mm. And, I mean, this went on. We saw so many occasions where the settlers were just an absolute law unto themselves. And there was one occasion when we were confronted, again, harvesting out at the almonds and confronting by a group of settlers. And they were, you know, they were just, I said, young people. But they intimidated and harassed. Well, and I turned around to say to the soldiers, well, come on, surely this is where you step in. And they were laughing and taking pictures of the harassment because they found it funny. And I mean, it's when you're up against that, it's horrible.
You listen to Isabel Phillips here, who's a peace volunteer who's been out working in Palestine, and she's coming to tell us her experiences. Lynn Papadopoulos, listening to that, I mean, does it strike you that these stories are not getting out? That's what strikes me.
Yeah, I mean, I was just wondering, were you filming any of that? And were you filming any of it at all?
I wasn't personally, but there is a programme now in the West Bank, which we were involved in, which aims to give Palestinians a video. I don't know if you recall over the summer the incident that came out when a Palestinian girl filmed an Israeli army commander holding a Palestinian who was bound while he ordered a soldier to shoot at him.
Yeah.
I mean, that made international news, fortunately, and that got out. But that was only because one girl had been given by an Israeli human rights organisation a camera to try and film life under occupation. And it was only, she didn't see that was very remarkable, that footage.
Yeah.
And it was only because some international volunteers that in a similar group to ourselves, they came across that and realised how horrific it was. I mean, I think it says something that the girl didn't even think to, this was remarkable.
Do you think if you had been filming that incident in the with the children in the fields, that you think that would have made a difference to what the Jewish settlers did and what the army did or didn't do?
Yeah, it should do. In theory, I would like to think it should do, but there's incidents. I mean, I was one of a number of internationals and similar incidents weren't filmed. And to be honest, I mean, I don't want to get into conspiracy theories or anything like that, but it's very, very difficult to let things get out there. And I mean, I would think that's a really important human interest story.
Yeah.
You know, it's just one family trying to live, basically, and you can't get them out there. It's so difficult.
Isabel, the Israeli government, of course, would say that they need this wall, they need defence, because Hamas, there are a lot of militants out there who try to kill, who want to kill Israelis, who want to destroy the state of Israel. That would be their defence. And that kind of is the reason that the Western governments, who are in collusion in a way, allow that to happen. What would you say to that? That we know that Hamas militants do kill and want to wipe Israel out, and that is their reason for keeping them down. What would you say to that?
Well, I think this is the main problem, and it's every single time the story of the Palestinian people is cut down by the security argument. Now, I'm not taking away from anything, as I said earlier, any suffering that Israeli people have gone. It's awful. It should never happen. Nobody should die. Nobody should be injured.
You're a peace campaign, so you're peace.
Like that goes without saying, that is wrong. But as I say, that's a handful, and it is a handful of militants. Like, there's 4 million Palestinians out there who are being collectively punished day after day after day. Like, they can't live their lives. They, you know, every day is a complete struggle. Like, there's no economy, they can't go to school, they have no work. And you can't punish a population when you're just fighting against one group. It's not a conflict and it's two states. And, I mean, going back to this wall, they say it's for security. But when that wall's complete, 40% of the West Bank will have been annexed by Israel. Mm. And we're talking about 40% of the West Bank, which, I mean, just to go back in history, that's 78% of the land that was originally Palestine has been taken by the Israeli state. They're left with 22%. And now they've come in with this wall, which they say is for security, but it takes 40% of what's the West Bank. So that leaves 11% of original Palestine. And this wall is being used as security. But it goes, it's about isolating, it's about cutting Palestine and the West Bank into cantons. There's no continuity in West Bank.
Do you think that Barack Obama might make a difference here? Because, I mean, that Israel is clearly a massive problem at the core of the Middle East crisis, if you like.
Yeah.
And it comes back to time after time again. You know, the treatment of Israel, the special treatment of Israel, as opposed to certain Arab states, is a big grudge that a lot of Arab groups use. When they're attacking the West. Now, we're told there's going to be a great new dawn, that Obama may be sympathetic, wants to change the perception of America around the world. Do you think that might make any difference?
Well, I mean, it'd be nice to think it would, to be honest, and I think we can all get carried away with this whole new change. I mean, I think you have to talk about how much can you really change. I mean, American politics, it's great Obama's got in, but really, there's only so much an American president can do, because it's not just about one man. And I mean, as we see, his chief of state is actually went and fought in for the Israeli Defense Force. He went, he has Israeli citizenship even. His dad actually last week made a comment in the Israeli newspapers saying, of course, he's going to support Israel. He's not going to the White House like an Arab. He's not going to be cleaning floors. So, I mean, I know that's his dad, and he's distance himself from those remarks. But I think the problem is, and I mean, I don't like going down the road that, you know, we'll never change anything, the Jewish lobby's too strong in America, because you have to look back at South Africa and apartheid, and public opinion does matter.
Yeah.
And I mean, we can, you know, if enough people stand up and say, I mean, we vote these people in over here, and people vote people in over America, and they're accountable to them. So I think it's important to be realistic in that he's not going to change everything, but you have to be optimistic and say there is hope. And if public opinion really, you know, can have a say, and it had a say in South Africa.
It's the big problem, I think I mentioned it earlier, but getting that voice out, getting your voice out, getting those stories out, telling the tale. Because, I mean, as I said at the moment, there's no media is allowed in the West Bank. It's been banned. And reading a report in The Guardian yesterday, they questioned why all of a sudden Israel has started shelling, has started shooting over there. It's all because it was very peaceful. It's almost the perception being they're trying to enrage the militants to start attacking again so they can say, look, there's the militants. This is our reason for keeping them down. Is there a conspiracy of silence? And do you find yourself coming up against that?
Yeah, I mean, I haven't personally found it in because, I mean, I'm just an ordinary person. And obviously I've had no problem telling people I'm associated with, my friends, everything. I mean, I haven't been met by, you know, unnamed letters popping through the door or anything like that. But I think one of the main things is people have this perception, oh, everything has to be reported equally and this. And so people tone down what's going on. And I find myself sometimes thinking, you know, I'm telling these stories, everything I saw. And I think I'm looking at people thinking, oh, you don't believe me. There's two sides of this story. But it's not six of one, half a dozen the other at all. It's the most unequal. Like it's not a conflict, as I said. You can't call it a conflict. And I think, as you were saying before, it's like they goading the Palestinians, you know, every time there is peace. I mean, my impression, and it is just my impression, is that the Israelis do not want peace whatsoever. Every time peace comes close, you know, they're antagonising, they're building these settlements and, you know, the outposts, which are the same as settlements, basically. 50 have been built in the last 5 years when they have all these Annapolis and peace talks that are meant to be saying, and Bush has said, yeah, okay, fine, but stop the settlements. They're still being built at a rate of knots. And I think what was clear, I mean, there was a huge attack in Gaza the night of the election, and I don't think that was, you know, nobody's going to be concentrating on Palestine when you've got the first black president being elected in America. And, so, you know, there really is strategic attacks going on, and it's not for the security of their population at all.
OK, Isabel, what can, I mean, you've come in very made up to hear you putting your experience across, found it very interesting. If people are listening and they want to help or they want to get involved, is there any website they can go to? Is there any kind of organisation they can...
Yeah, I mean, in Liverpool, we have the Liverpool Friends of Palestine.
Right.
Now, I mean, I can leave contact details for that group with you if anyone's interested. Or on the first Saturday of every month, we go to St Luke's Church where we hold a vigil and we give out leaflets and we try and get this story across. I mean, it's good even just to talk to people to learn more about it.
Have they got a website?
It's not, no, not a website as such, no, it's more just contact through emails, which I can leave with
you. Yeah, do that.
There's Jews for Justice for Palestinians, which is also, that's active in Liverpool. And then there's the Palestine Solidarity Campaign, which is based in London, but that has a lot of branches. I can give out their website. That's www.palestinecampaign.org. And there's a lot of information on there. I mean, I think this is one of the main problems, is that we just don't have the information. Mm-hmm. And once you start reading and exploring this issue, I cannot stress enough how apparent it becomes that what is going on is injustice, apartheid. It's, you know, it's just horrific. I've never seen something so awful in my life. So it's really important that people just get to know what's going on.
The best of Brian Reid on City Talk 105.9.
If Chris Burt, my producer, can get himself in the studio, we might be able to have an insult quiz. I'm going to insult him now. I'm going to insult him. We haven't got long. We've only got a few insults to get out.
We cannot be late for the insult quiz.
Can't have a Saturday without an insult quiz, can we, Lynn? Eh?
We can't. I actually realised I don't listen. I don't listen to any of these questions. I just really want to win.
You get your excuse in early, aren't you? Eh?
I just have a group of names that, you know, it's either Kate Moss, Kelly Katona, Heather.
I'm sorry, and listen, Chris, you were a little one today. You're the king of this quiz. You've got to sit down and take part.
Sorry about that.
We've got a few minutes to go. Okay, we're going to go straight into it. Who said this? Can you get pregnant eating crocodile testicles?
Somebody in that jungle television programme.
Good enough.
Nicola Big Boobs.
I'm going to give it to you. Nicola McLean. Nicola said Kirby won, Red Cornell, but you kind of helped there, but you're doing too well anyway. Okay. David Morrissey has said this about what? I am not allowed to talk about that.
Whether he'll be the next Doctor Who.
On the ball. Who said this? Oh, I drink like a fish. I don't hide no bones about it.
Kerry.
Oh, it's a mank. It's a mank boxer. Oh, I drink like a fish. I don't hide no bones about
Ricky
it.
Ricky Hatton.
Oh, this is quick and on the ball. I like it. Right, OK. Kevin Maguire is talking about who? He was famous for being elbowed out of the way on the telly by Maggie Thatcher. In Westminster, he was, I think it's fair to say, viewed as pompous and extremely self-regarding. And it's amazing he's found fame again by being pushed around by a woman, although this time it's on a dance floor.
John Sargent.
Former Echo Man John Sargent, please.
Oh, sorry, former Echo.
It's 2-2. KB2, red card 2. Who's Piers Morgan talking about here, OK? You've got to think who Morgan doesn't like. There's a couple he hates, you know, but, so there you go. Blah, blah.
Jerry Blair.
Nearly.
Stein Meat.
Yes, nearly. Blah, blah has been injured while deliberately driving a lorry into a wall. And for once, I'm completely behind him. In fact, I think Blah, Blah should be allowed to keep driving vehicles into walls as long as he likes.
Not the Yorkshire Ripper, but Jeremy Clarkson.
And they're one and the same team. But yeah, red car, 3, Herbie 2. OK. Back to celebrity, get me out of here. Sue Carroll. 3 words to sum up why I'm a celebrity, get me out of here, will be a resounding success in uniting this country against bossiness, nitpicking and the rampant greed of the political classes.
Robert Kilroy Silk.
Very good. Whoa, KB3. Red car 3, you're on the ball today, aren't you? OK. Callum Malone is speaking about... Who's this, she's saying? In an interview last week, Blah Blah said she'll run for president in 2012 if Gad opens a door for her.
Sarah Palin? That's yeah. My namesake?
The punchline was, but only if he doesn't open it for Bart Simpson and Superman first. So Kirby, four. Oh.
She talked about doors quite a lot in that speech, didn't she? I remember. Mm. If there's a door.
Blah Blah reckons he's about to be made a lord. Not anymore, he isn't. Not once the nation has seen him munching a crocodile's gonads. Not once we've seen him bitching about the other contestants and running scared from a few spiders. Anyway, what's he done to deserve a lordship? This is the man they used to call Captain Crackpot and who attracted flack as commander of Lambeth Police because he favoured a softly opposed to drugs and wanted police to be more liberal. His first name is...
Brian Paddock.
Brian Paddock. Yes. Look at this. It's
a nail-biting
what is it now?
Finish.
Is it red card 4, KB?
Four all.
Four apiece. Have we got time for any more? Juice has gone missing.
Tiebreaker.
Have we got time for any more? Maybe we've got a couple. Derek McGovern. Oh, we've got plenty of time. Derek McGovern. The new favourite for I'm a Celebrity is former star... I know. This is what everyone's been talking about that you didn't read about. Or watch. The new favourite for I'm a Celebrity is former Star Trekker Blah Blah, whose cheerfulness has not subsided despite being denied a ticket to the paddock enclosure.
We're just saying his name.
Yeah.
Just. George Takei.
Wow.
Sulu.
I'm really impressed.
Oh,
five.
How am I supposed to get that?
5-4.
He's not even a celebrity.
A ticket to the paddock enclosure. I thought that was good. Okay. Who said this? Blah Blah does a bit of staring too, saying of singer Cheryl Cole, no, there's not enough of her. She's too thin. Oh. A healthy girl is a fat-bottomed creature.
I've forgotten her name. The feminists have forgotten her name.
Jermaine Greer.
I gave that to him, didn't I?
I've got to give that to Kirby.
You would not have got that if it wasn't for me.
I think we've got time for one more. We have got time for one more very quickly. Okay. What programme is Ali Ross talking about here? Get ready. Fingers on the buzzer. An event damaged beyond repair by Wogan's BBC fee. The endless plugging.
Children in need.
Children in need. Red Cross 6. Kirby 5.
City Talk 105.9.
Welcome back. This is Brian Reid bringing you the best of my Saturday morning show here on City Talk 105.9, The Voice of Liverpool. It seems to have been the Liverpool Echo since stories were filed via pigeons. He's one of the longest-serving, colourful, talented and at times controversial journalists the Echo's ever had. It's Joe Riley. Welcome, mate.
Hello, Brian. Good to be here. I sat by you for how many years?
Oh, quite a few, actually, on and off.
Typing away
in those days. I was thinking the other day, I only joined it once, in 1987, which is 21 years ago. And you seem to have been there for a long time then. When did you join the Echo?
I joined the Daily Post first in 1971 and then the Echo in 74, so that's 34 years.
So, the Post and Echo, 37 years.
Yes.
It is almost that man and boy thing, isn't it?
almost.
Now, Joe, that's a long time. That's a long time to have chronicled the goings-on in this city.
It's the last entire quarter of the 20th century and a bit more.
Yeah. Now, Joe's got a book out at the moment. This isn't why he's on, as he's just said to me, I don't like these people to come on and plug. He was coming on anyway. But he has got a book out. It's called Maka, the Saint and the Screen Goddess. It's basically people he's interviewed. And it is almost a cast list of the last century's greats. I mean, we've got Bob Dylan, Yoko Ono, McCartney, Quentin Crisp, Dame Edna, Norman... I mean, just Leonard Rossiter, Clive Barker. It's... You've interviewed Jack Jones. There's some great people in this, mate, I'll tell you.
Both Jack Joneses.
Both Jack Joneses, yeah. the singer and the trainee. Arthur Askey. Jesus, I didn't know you'd been around that long.
Yeah, yeah.
When did he die, Arthur Askey?
Arthur Askey died 20 years ago, but the thing is, he lived in London with his sister latterly, and he had heart failure, and he ended up having to have his legs amputated. It was horrible,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah.
Poor thing. And he told me a very interesting story that his wife, May, never really understood his success. And he did 6 Royal Command shows, as they were called in those days. Not variety shows, Royal Command shows. You were commanded to go before the monarch. And he'd come home from doing a Royal Command. She never went to the Palladium to see him and tell her how it went. And then she'd say, I had a really good bargain this afternoon. I got the cheapest brown loaf at Harrods. I mean, she just never clued in to his success. Maybe that's a good thing. You don't really want to take your work home, do you?
She was the power behind the throne. Rex Harrison. Now, when you interviewed Rex, please tell me you turned around and said, look, mate, don't go on about Ayton. I don't remember it.
Well, I didn't do that because I'd sort of looked up the fact he came from Ayton. But no, Rex Harrison was a bit of an enigma, a very arrogant man, I have to say.
Yeah.
But he... you know, was a great fan of George Bernard Shaw. And so the thing is that history very often connects with all these things.
Mm-hmm.
Not in that book, but I always remember meeting the pianist Arthur Rubinstein. That was in 1974. And he was, I think by then, in his early 90s, and I was in my mid-20s. And at the end of the concert in the green room, he shook my hand. He said, you are now shaking the hand that shook the hand of Brahms. Because Brahms died in 1897 when he was already 10.
Yeah.
And the whole thing is, you know, suddenly history collapses. And there's another one in there just as an example of that sort of thing. And that's Oscar Wilde's grandson. Because...
he's a big hero, Oscar Wilde.
Well, sort of. But, in fact, last week in Paris, I went to the Hotel d'Alsace in Rue des Beaux-Arts, where he died, saying the wallpaper had to go, or he had to go, and he went. But he died in 1900, Oscar Wilde, and then his children were late in life, and then they had children late in life. So you only got to do that twice, and you've bridged more than a century.
Yeah.
And Merlin Holland, who was the wine writer for the Oldie magazine, very civilised man, you know, is still with us. And although people say, you know, 5 generations ago I was related to whatever historical figure, you can relate to your granddad, can't you, in that sense?
But it shows how little time we have on this earth and how things are quite... I interviewed once in France. She was the oldest woman alive. I think she was 111. She didn't quite... wasn't a great interview. Didn't get much copy out of it, put that way. But she'd actually remembered Van Gogh.
Yeah,
she used to work at a. She worked in a. Her dad ran a paint shop, and she went. Then she said his breath really stunk.
Well, Van Gogh.
Van Gogh's breath. But that's the kind of, you know, you can touch history and just go back.
Yeah, just by one person.
It's
like Tony Benn.
Tony Benn's. I've met every Labour Prime Minister ever, going back to Ramsay MacDonald, and you know, met them and talked to them.
Fantastic, in that sense.
We're honoured in a way, really, in that job, aren't we, journalists?
Well, I've just done a thing about that book today in the Echo, saying that, you know, most people meet one or two famous people in their life, maybe. And I have, by good fortune and employment, been bombarded with them, you know. Mm. In fact, I forgot until the other day, and there's no insult to the person concerned, that I'd ever met Donald Sinden. I read an interview with Donald Sinden last weekend and suddenly realised, gosh, yes, I had lunch with him once in Manchester. I'd actually forgotten.
It's actually forgotten.
You know, but because there are so many of them, you know, to get a bit blasé. But there's a lot of tin pot celebrities around. There's real celebrities.
A-list.
There's inflated ego celebrities, and there's fake celebrities.
You've mainly, I mean, obviously, been working on the Echo, being the arts editor. Is that still your
title?
Yes, I still do that. I do lots of things.
Yes,
but I mean, when I was there, you used to meet a lot of people through doing the films.
Yeah,
you're a film reviewer.
Yeah,
and in fact, it was famously over a pint with you on Friday. You went, oh, where were you yesterday? I was in London. Funny enough, I was having a pee next to Tom Cruise. And I went, what one? Yeah, he's a little, not very interesting. And I kind of thought, you just had a kind of pee next to Tom Cruise yesterday. Is that kind of, you do become blasé?
Well, yeah, you get to know them. I mean, Jack Nicholson.
That's right.
Who I now know, as against just bump into. I persuaded him to lend a painting of his to the Walker Art Gallery for an exhibition.
Really?
And it was only a small painting, but anyway, I was the link that sort of said, go on, lend it to them. And it just had underneath, you'd have to be very sort of erudite to realise, in very small type, J. Nicholson, California. But that's where it was. It was his painting lent to the Walker Art Gallery.
Yeah. We're name dropping here, aren't we? So I'm going to carry on. I interviewed Muhammad Ali once and got him to sign a photo for the Mount Vernon pub. So there's a pub, I think it's on eBay now, but there was for a while the Mount Vernon, which is my local, a picture of Muhammad Ali signed to the Mount Vernon. Well, all these people just come in and go, has he had a pint in here?
Well, one of my memories of you sitting opposite me at the Echo for years was you phoning up Ian Paisley to get an interview. And it was like one of those cartoon things where, you know, you see in cartoons where you can hear the voice down the phone as well. And you said, I'd like to do an interview, to which he said, when's it going in? And you said, well, I'm not quite sure yet. He said, phone me back when it's planned. I always remember that. And we could hear the phone, the other end of the phone all over the office.
Yeah, I never did go in that one.
Didn't it?
Didn't go in. So, I mean, 37 years, Joe, it's a long time. But you've kept really fresh. I mean, without remission. You've still got a very good column at the moment, and which is controversial. And you enjoy. I sense winding up the establishment and throwing in a few little hand grenades there. You know, the city council, which I think is what
you do that in your column as well. Well, in the Mirror. I mean, the whole point is people. You know, somebody wrote in the other day saying I was anti Gordon Brown because I criticised Gordon Brown, but I'm not anti Gordon Brown at all. And then the week before, you know, hammered David Cameron. Our job is not to be partisan, particularly, you know, because it would be boring and predictable. I just say what I think about whatever it is, and you could look back through columns, and they say you could do it with yours, and you could, if you were of that mind, align them to any political line of thought, you know.
Mm. But what I think is, what I found is particularly hard, Liverpool is a big city, but it's a small village as well.
Yeah.
And it's quite often, if you are a local journalist in a place like Liverpool or any city, the establishment kind of gets you a bit because you've got to go out and see these people and you're everywhere. When you write about the council, for example, and you have a go, which you have done for years, it kind of gets magnified 1,000 times because they don't get a lot of criticism. And that's when it becomes quite brave in a way. I mean, one of the very few things that Richard Littlejohn said that I agree with is that the role of a columnist is to be sitting at the back of the hall throwing bottles on the stage. And it kind of is in a way because you're there to kind of stir things. You're there to point out things that the reader, identify what they're thinking and then just kind of go at authority with it.
And the thing is, you know, they wait around in clusters for you, you know, because it's a small city. And the same people turn up at the same dues very often, especially what I call the town hall sherry brigade.
Yeah.
They're all standing around in clusters on street corners, you know, mumbling about you as you go past. You just have to be thick-skinned.
Yeah. And also with you doing the art side of it. Now, again, you're very honest in your criticism. You will say what you think. But that can be hard sometimes, can't it? When you know it's a local playwright or it's a local filmmaker and they've poured, you know, hours into it and they're really hoping for a good review. You don't tend to take any prisoners, do you?
Recent example of that was Terence Davis. I've known him for years. Great bloke. Lovely man, actually. He did Distant Voices, Still Lives. I still think that's a classic film. And then this latest film came out. Yes. And, well, you were there, weren't you?
Yeah,
I saw you there. And, you know, the various papers, including The Guardian, said it was a masterpiece. I didn't think it was a masterpiece at all. It was like a cut-and-paste job, you know. It was just still old footage snipped together with dear old Terence trying to sound very profound and even like Oscar Wilde, dare I say, you know, booming a sometimes amusing soundtrack over it. And it was very interesting. I mean, don't get me wrong, but it wasn't a masterpiece.
I thought the production side with Roy Bolton and Saul Papadopoulos from Hurricane Films was excellent. You gave it 7 out of 10, but you were being honest. That was one of those films which divided opinion. It would be very easy to go along with the masterpiece live. You didn't think that.
No, I didn't.
And you said it, even though it was a Liverpool kind of film.
Yeah. And I've actually criticised friends of mine, because you get to know some of these people socially, you know, sort of rather adversely at times, including my one-time music teacher, but we won't go into that. But the whole point is that, you know, if you don't do it honestly, you lose your credibility.
Yeah.
And then you get people saying, he only said that because he knows him or something. Well, the fact is, if you praise someone you know, they'll think it's authentic. If you say what you think, you know, don't take any prisoners.
Joe, 37, I came back to 37 years, I don't know if I'm trying to make you feel old, but how has journalism changed in that time? Because it's changed massively.
When I first went into journalism, even before then, in the late 1960s, I mean, you typed your copy on single half folios of paper on a typewriter, one paragraph per page. Mm. And I don't know how I ever, when I look back, you know, now you can look at things as a whole on a screen. I don't know how you ever put together an article of 1,000 words. There were bits of paper anyway. And the, instead of knocking out characters on a screen like you would now to make it sort of flow, you just had to type X's through all the mistakes and bits. Yeah. You mentioned that I was there when, almost by pigeon carrier, but of course the famous story was at the Victoria Street Liverpool Echo, which I remember, is that pigeons did bring the results, from football Anfield results Evans. From Anfield, yes.
People would believe that, but
they did.
they used to, because it was a lot quicker, they'd put the results in the pigeon's
that's
mouth
right.
if a goal was scored for the football pink.
That's right.
And a pigeon would be offline over Anfield. Right. I mean, wasn't that long ago.
So that's how it's changed. Yeah. But one thing you mentioned that was interesting, you mentioned about Terence Davis and giving it 7 out of 10, which I'd forgotten myself. This whole thing out of 10, you know, people are obsessed with
that. Yeah, they are.
Now, national papers do star ratings and whatever, but... I've never personally been a fan of how many out of 10, because I think you should read the copy. Just go back and put a big number on it. But the fact is, people have become obsessed with this, and they shout out in, you know, well, they don't shout out in concert halls and things, but after they go, how many out of 10, you know? And people always want a high score, you know.
Yeah.
Now, it's like homework. In, you know, when I was at school in the 50s and 60s, you know, if you didn't get a 9 or 8 out of 10, you hadn't done very well.
Mm.
But if you actually think about it, 5 out of 10 is average.
It's a pass.
Average, yeah. 4 out of 10 is not good. But 5 out of 10 upwards. So if people get 5 and 6 now, they're quite insulted.
Be grateful.
You know? Be grateful. You're above average.
But it's funny, you know, footballers, they mark footballers, you know, I kind of after an international game marks out of 10. And I know for a fact that that's what annoys them and obsesses them more than anything, because the whole performance being judged by somebody go yawning and going, oh, I think it's probably a 6, wasn't it? You know, it kind of gets to them. But I mentioned earlier about the fact that, you know, you can upset local politicians and they're there waiting for you because that's their life, because nobody mentions them outside Liverpool, you know, the Warren Bradleys or whatever. So when you say something, it's kind of exposing
them. The thing is, Private Eye's been doing this for years. National papers have been doing this for years. They'd had rather a cosy time in Liverpool historically. And there is a difference of how people view local papers. I remember doing a TV review of something that Paul O'Grady had done and said, don't give up your day job, you know.
Yeah.
That was that TV series where it was set in a bingo hall.
Oh, it was, yeah.
Dreadful thing. And it had been slammed in the Nationals as well. But because it was slammed in the Liverpool Echo, he took great unction at this.
Yeah.
You know, it's not what they expect from their local paper. The local paper is meant to be like going home to Auntie or going to see Father Christmas, isn't it? You know, to a lot of people. They take comfort in it, you know.
And that's wrong. Because if you can't be honest, your job is to be honest. Every journalist's job is to be honest with the readership.
Yeah, but historically, they're not, I'm going back years now, they're not used to it. You know, it's the local paper. The local paper's their home base, and you can say what you want in London, and Private Eye can do what it wants to do for 40 years. But once you start doing that in the Echo, so there was a bit of a sea change there, and I'm just about getting used to it now, I think.
Yeah. Have you had any run-ins with local playwrights or for slagging them off, for slagging the performances?
I've been hit 3 times.
That's what I'm getting at.
Yes, yes, punched. Julian Oldfield at the Gateway Theatre was the first to take. He's, I don't know where he is now, long took exception. The chap, Bobby, was it Bobby? No, I don't think it was Bobby Eaton, to be fair. It was somebody who'd done... a rock and roll thing at the Everyman.
Oh, I remember that.
But it wasn't Bob.
It was Bob someone, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. Yeah, it was, I think. And then there was Chris Bond took great exception to my review of, what was it? He did a version of Sweeney Todd, because, of course, he co-invented Sweeney Todd before Sondheim took it and made it into a musical. So people can get very stroppy and uppity.
You have been smacked.
I have been smacked, yes, by various... slapped, really, in the theatre, isn't it?
It seems to be a kind of thing that goes on in the theatre, though. You do hear a lot of theatre critics, or maybe food critics as well, but the kind of... They really take it seriously, don't they?
What's so sort of false about the whole situation is if you say someone's good or you praise them, and hopefully you mean it, they think you're marvellous and how profound you are, you know, and if you say they're rubbish, you know, you don't know anything.
Yeah.
You can't have it both ways. Yeah. You know, the one thing that you do get reviewing over such a long period of time is a sense of perspective. So, you know, let's take Joseph and the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat, which you must have seen, like, you know, 24 times or something. I can tell you who were the better ones and who were the worst ones and stuff. But then you get the Joseph fans who are so close to it and so subjective about it. They just love everything and do standing ovations every time. And therefore, if you say anything at all, you know, the famous letter, which they pull my leg out about at the Echo, is, was I at the same show as Joe Riley? And the thing is, they probably only ever go to Joseph once a year. I mean, I may be wrong in that, but I mean, the fact is, if you're going to 2 and 3 things a week, every week, you know, you're talking hundreds and hundreds of shows here, you do get a sense of perspective. So you get Pete Postlethwaite mate coming back to do King Lear. It was okay.
You didn't like it,
I sort of quite liked it. I didn't like everything about it. But the fact is, there was this tendency beforehand in people's minds to venerate it in advance because it was Pete Postlethwaite, because he was coming back to the Everyman, because it was Capital of Culture and so on. Well, you can't just, you can't assume, if we want to have a legacy after Capital of Culture, we'll just have to grow up and become more realistic about how we evaluate things. You know, you can't just have, because a star's in town and doing something rather special, it must be good, you know, and there is that assumption still.
I mean, you know, nearly four decades you've been writing about the culture of Liverpool in the most literal sense, and now we've got Capital of Culture Year. What were your preconceptions about it, and has it lived up or lived down to them?
Well, the things that have worked best are the things that have involved most people. What I mean by that is, you know, tall ships, the spider going through the streets, things, mass involvement that's got people out. Those are the things that have worked most. Yeah. I've always said, I've rather banged on about this actually, until Capital of Culture came down your street and changed your life for the better, it might as well never have happened. So, you know, a cosy symphony at the Phil or a sort of a play at the Unity or something, good as they may be, isn't seismic in changing the sort of population's approach to Capital of Culture. So Capital of Culture is much more to do, or the benefits will be much more to do with raising Liverpool's profile, which has undoubtedly happened. The city has been transformed. Going into Liverpool One's like going into a city within a city now. It's still amazing in that sense. And there seem to be a lot of people around this morning. We don't seem to be credit crunching this morning. But what I mean is the perception of the city. The good news beforehand is we had these five themed run-up years. That was fantastic. When you look at Cork in Ireland, God bless them, they sort of got going the November before, you know. So there was this tremendous awareness. The downside of the tremendous awareness is it builds up huge tsunami of anticipation. And if anything goes wrong, and plenty of things did en route, especially spectacular fallouts with certain personalities involved, that was detrimental. But looking back, you know, because it's almost over, it has been a success. And we, in order to avoid a big hangover next year in every sense, we've just got to make sure that we keep the game up, you know.
I mean, but, is that possible?
Well, money, of course, plays a great part. I mean, if you take the Philharmonic, they've had 30 premieres this season. That, no way is they're going to be able to afford that next year because there won't be the special money around. But hopefully, with Vasily Petrenko and the profile of the Phil, more people will be going. Similarly, the theatre's profile is gone up. And I think really the star of the year has been National Museums with their exhibitions and things, whether it's Klimt, bringing Klimt here, or whether it's doing an in-house exhibition like the Age of Steam and things like that, which was sensationally good. And we've got a new Egyptian gallery, if that's the right word, Egyptology or whatever, opening on the 5th of December. Full of stuff, full of mummies, and but it's fantastic. You know, that, I mean,
things are really up, aren't they?
And of course, the reason they're up. Capital of Culture wouldn't have been nearly as successful if most of the events hadn't been free to attend, the big events. That is the key, really, free access to these things. If they started charging, heaven forbid, for the museums again, the figures would fall, you know. So free access has been the key. And I think people, once they've been, you know, it's just getting them over the doorstep first time to go to the theatre. Or to go to a concert or to go to an exhibition. You know, some people think it's not for them. Then they go and they're quite delighted and hopefully they'll keep on doing that.
How do you think that big building out there we're looking at is going to work? The not the Liverpool building. the Museum of Liverpool Life? Is that what
you're going to call it?
Museum of Liverpool Life?
No, just the Museum of Liverpool. But I call it the sunbed, the X-shaped building.
Yeah.
Well, that would be fantastic because we'd be able to have, apart from anything else, really big objects. The train that was involved in the Titchfield Thunderbolt, which is stored in a warehouse in Bootle at the moment, will be on show. So will sort of the old tram cars and the really big exhibits that we've got that nobody ever sees. And there'll be a Beatles bit, I gather. What else?
Room for plenty of egos there.
Room for plenty of that. But we have this tremendous heritage, you know, which we can put on.
Can we fill that building with Liverpool?
I'm sure we can, because we've filled warehouses in Bootle at the moment with them. They're just not. I went to see a thing called Ramesses Girdle, which is the pharaoh Ramesses used to wear this sort of strapping girdle to go into battle. Apparently it's better than any example found in Tutankhamun's tomb. And it's in this box, you know, secured by 12 electric rivets and everything. It was all opened up and shown. It is fantastic when you think how old it is, 5,000 years or whatever. And that's waiting to go on show in the New Egyptology Museum. But when I went to see that, what I'm really getting at is I went into this warehouse stashed full of stuff that, you know, is not on show. So it won't be any blank corners.
Yeah.
You've got plenty of stuff out there.
You've been, I mean, at the top of your game now for a long time, Joe. Do you ever feel, do you regret that you didn't leave Liverpool and go to London? Because you clearly had the ability to do so.
I got an opportunity to go three times to London. One was to be, you'll understand this, a sub-editor on the Daily Express. Sub-editors aren't quite as important as they sound. There's a whole team of them. They lay out pages and
not many
whatever.
Of them left now,
not many left now. Sadly. So there's to do that. I didn't want to do that. I got the offer of being the theatre, the deputy theatre critic on a London, on a weekend national paper. But the thing there, as my good friend Michael Billington will attest, who was me at the Echo before he went to the Guardian, that would be just doing theatre. And you'd be somebody's deputy. Great advice in life to anyone listening, anywhere, in any profession. Never be anyone's deputy.
Yeah.
They always don't want you to do better than them.
Yeah.
And you only get to do what they don't want to do. So never be anyone's deputy, number one. But so I didn't want to do that for that reason also. And the reason being that staying here, you know, it may sound a bit presumptuous, but this is like you get your own patch. And, I cover within the context of the arts, there's the visual arts, there's music, as you say, there's film and interviews and stuff. So it does keep, the variety is what's kept me here.
Yeah.
And the fact is that the quality of the variety is so good.
Yeah.
I mean, we've got six theatres, two cathedrals. The cathedrals have a whole music programme of their own. We've got the Philharmonic, you know. It's not like I have friends on other papers in the country, like, let me think, the Lincoln Echo is a good example. A lovely lady there who I'm a friend of. And when they want to get a local celebrity to say anything, I think they've got Gary, is it Gary Lineker from there? And Engelbert Humperdinck, and that's it.
Leicester, yeah.
Oh, Leicester, so Leicester Mercury. Yeah. Well, there we are. I've got Gary Lineker. That's their celebrity list for the town. Now, we produced and have done, we are rather good at doing this, supplements and supplements of 100 best Scousers, and there's still room for a second lot. I remember when I met Jeremy Isaacs, the judge of the Capital of Culture, and presented him with 100 reasons why Liverpool should be Capital of Culture with all these names and things. And he said to me, because they couldn't really show their hand in those days, it had to be very diplomatic, but I thought it was a very interesting leading hint when he said, yes, and you could have produced another 100, couldn't you?
Yeah.
Now, there's no other city in Britain, Manchester, Birmingham, any of them. No, because they don't count London.
Yeah.
It's just a huddle of villages, you know. It could be anywhere. There's no other city in the country could produce that. So it's been a very good patch to have.
Yeah.
And still is.
You've been listening to the best of Brian Reid. I'll be back next Saturday morning at 10 o'clock. Stay tuned for Tricia Goddard here on City Talk 105.9, the voice of Liverpool.
Of Brian Reid, City Talk 105.9. Listen, and log on to the voice of Liverpool, City Talk 105.9.